today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Solomon thought of the good and the bad as they were described. And he says, listen, God makes it all beautiful in its time. But then he says something glorious in verse 11. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts. The preacher understood that man has an awareness and a longing for the eternal, and that God has put it in their hearts. We can say that eternity is in our hearts because we are made in the image of an eternal God.
Many people today have given themselves over to despair, believing that humans are the product of random chance. As a result, they spend their lives with the attitude, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." If we believe that we're made by a caring God who has a plan for us, it truly makes a difference in how we approach life and living. Pastor David will be sharing more observations about life from King Solomon, as well as showing the solution to this desperate way of thinking. Now here's Pastor David with part three of his message, Time, Eternity, and Despair.
See, here we see that the preacher's no atheist. He certainly believes in God, but the God of the preacher, at least under his under-the-sun premise, the God of the preacher is not the God who matters. He's not the God who gives meaning to life as he's connected in eternity. Maybe he's the grandfatherly old God with the big beard and the rocking chair up in heaven, right? Oh, there's a God, but he doesn't really matter. The God of the preacher simply teaches us to make the best of a bad situation. And so he really collapses down into fatalism. I like what G. Campbell Morgan said about this. He said, everything is vanity. To live under the sun is to decide at last that the natural thing to do is to just take what comes. Materialism necessarily becomes fatalism. And Solomon says, well, I can do that. For who can eat and drink and who can have enjoyment more than I? Given the preacher's premise, his life should be the best in a meaningless world. He could enjoy this world of despair better than anyone else. Yet his life was almost infinitely more poor than the most humble life lived with true meaning. You know, you'll meet people. I'll speak honestly. Maybe you're one of those people. By human observation, on the under-the-sun kind of scale, you got everything. You got it all. But if you're not living your life for eternal meaning, your life has no meaning. The words of the preacher resonate with your heart in the book of Ecclesiastes. I'll say this to you, sir or ma'am, who seems to have everything in the under-the-sun kind of rules. You are almost infinitely poorer than the most simple man or woman who has true eternal meaning to their life. And if you were wise, you would do everything you could to believe in the God of the Bible and the eternity that is to come, and to realize that your life, your deeds, your aspirations will be judged in light of eternity. And then here in verse 26, he almost gives a throwaway line. He says, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who's good in his sight. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who's good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. You see, Solomon reflected on how sometimes it seems that what the sinner has gathered and collected is given to him who is good before God. Now, that might seem unjust. But under the sun, sometimes injustice seems to work in someone's favor. So he says, okay, great. This is also vanity and grasping for the wind. Even this seeming or sometimes redistribution from God's hand was not enough to give true meaning to life lived under the sun. So we leave chapter 2 on this very downbeat note. We come into chapter 3. And to see him sort of discussing another idea in this premise. Verse 1. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones. A time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. A time to gain, a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. It's a beautiful section, isn't it? Of course, you can't really say those lines without thinking of that great bird song running through your mind, right? You can hear the guitar riff even as I'm mentioning that. Listen, to everything there is a season and a purpose, a time for every purpose under heaven. This list that describes the different seasons and facets of life, it's a beautiful list and it's very beautifully written, is it not? Yet it also casts a very dark shadow. Because it reminds us of the inevitability of trouble and evil and of the relentless monotony of life. You see, the repetition of a time and a time and a time. After a while, it almost seems oppressive to us. I like what Derek Kidner said about this. He says, whatever may be our skill and our initiative, our real masters seem to be these unstoppable seasons. Not only those of the calendar, but of that tide of events which moves us from one now to one kind of action which seems to be fitting and another which puts it all into reverse. Let me put it this way. Do you ever feel like you're a slave to the calendar? Don't even raise your hand on that one. Right? It's a terrible feeling, isn't it? Sometimes it doesn't make you feel more than that life is meaningless. When you really feel like you're a slave to the calendar, that one day passes, the events just, you're under dominion of time and the events, and this comes and that comes. You got no control over it all. You're just in bondage to this. That's how we felt. And even though it's beautifully said, so beautifully that when the birds did that song, Turn, 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 they didn't write it. Pete Seeger wrote it. But when they did that song, it became a number one hit. Did you know Solomon had a number one hit in the U.S.? I hope they gave him the songwriting credit for that, but I don't think they did. Notice how it begins this list in verse 2. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to break down, a time to build up. Birth and death, these are the boundaries of life under the sun. So that's mentioned first. And in this whole list, a bad facet answers each good facet. Yeah, there's good things like birth, but then there's bad things like death. There's good things like building up. There's bad things like breaking down. The preacher understood that even though there are good things in life, the bad things can't be escaped. They say that in ancient Egypt, when they were having a party, when they were having a feast, a banquet, that they would pass around a little coffin, little toy, almost coffin to everybody in the midst of the party, basically to say to everybody, hey, you're having a good time now, but you're going to die. I don't know if that's a great way to run a party or not, but it sounds a lot like Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? Yeah, you know, you may be having a good day, a good week, a good occurrence, beautiful. But don't ever forget that good thing in the life, that birth of the child, it's going to be offset by a death somewhere. That beautiful planting of something else is going to get plucked up. That embrace is going to be coupled to a refraining from embracing. You get the point. Over and over again. What I like about the poetic quality of this list, the beauty in this list, is it shows us that even the tragic, dark aspects of life can be artistically and powerfully presented. I see that in a lot of the art of this world. A lot of the music, a lot of the film, a lot of the novels, a lot of the writing. I find that oftentimes people who don't know God at all can very artfully and sometimes beautifully describe the lost condition of mankind. What they can't tell you is the solutions. But man, if you want the problem, the world can tell it to you. Because they see it. They know it, just like Solomon ached because of it. In verse 9, we have something. I don't want you to get too excited about this. But in verse 9, we see a glimmer of hope. Enjoy it, because you're not going to get much of this until the end of the book. But just for a moment, Solomon lifts his eyes up to eternity. See what I mean? Verse 9. What profit has the worker from that which he labors? I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He has also put eternity in their hearts. Except that no man can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. First in verse 9, he asks the question, what profit is the worker from that which he labors? I've seen the God-given task which the sons of men are to be occupied. The preacher asked the kind of question he had asked before, but this time he found an answer. The God-given task that God gives to man. Now right there, that's meaning for your life, isn't it? If you believe that God mattered and he actually gave you a task to do in this world, that changes everything, doesn't it? Suddenly your life isn't meaningless. Suddenly your life has a purpose. God gave me something to do. And I'm going to do it unto his glory. And then he says next that he's made everything beautiful in its time. And this is consideration of the poetic list in the previous section. Solomon thought of the good and the bad as they were described. And he says, listen, God makes it all beautiful in its time. But then he says something glorious in verse 11. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts. The preacher understood that man has an awareness and a longing for the eternal. And that God has put it in their hearts. We can say that eternity is in our hearts because we are made in the image of an eternal God. Isn't that beautiful? Friends, he's programmed you this way. One of the fascinating things from this is the well-known missionary and author Don Richardson used that phrase, eternity in their hearts, to write a book by that same title, Eternity in Their Hearts. If you've never read it, I highly recommend it. He talks about his work among Aboriginal tribes in different places in the world and how he found that when he did a little bit of research in the culture and in the thinking and in the mentality of those tribes, he would find connections to biblical truth. They would have a story or a legend or a tradition about a God who gave his son to help people. They would have this tradition or that tradition. And so often he could connect them back. And Richardson says it's because God has put eternity in their hearts. It's something that God has put in all of our hearts, except, he says at the end of verse 11, that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. Though God has given man a longing for and an awareness of eternity, God has not revealed very much about his eternal work. This keeps the yearning for eternity alive in the heart of man as a yet-to-be-fulfilled longing. Now, this phenomenon that Solomon speaks of, this phenomenon of eternity being in our hearts, I mean, I think we would just agree that it's true, right? It's true by observation, not only by Solomon's declaration. And I wonder, how can evolution explain such a thing? Right? It's just beyond explanation in any natural way. But it's beautifully explained if we are indeed made in the image of an eternal God. Verse 12. I know that nothing is better than for them to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. You see, in light of God's making everything beautiful and his gift of eternity in their hearts, then it's wise to receive the good things of this world and to receive them as the gift of God. Okay, knowing that my labor has meaning because God gave me work to do, knowing that God has put eternity in my heart, and that must mean there is an eternity, then I can enjoy the good things of this world. And I'm not looking to them to give my life meaning. No, I already have meaning in my life from God. Now I can enjoy those things legitimately and wonderfully. This is what he says in verse 12. I know this. But now in verse 14, he knows something else. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing can be taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him, that which has already been and what has already has been, and God requires an account of what is past. Oh, don't miss that last line. He's finding meaning. He's considered eternity. He's considered the work that God has given to every man. And then he says so wonderfully there at the end of verse 15, God requires an account for what is past. Friends, if God requires an account from you and me, then everything we do has meaning. Not nothing. Under the sun, nothing has meaning. Under eternity and the fact that we will give account before God for what we do, everything has meaning. I think most of us fail to appreciate how meaningful and significant our lives really are. I think you may be thinking that way. You may have been basically told the lie, believe the PR from an under-the-sun world, that your life isn't very significant, that your life doesn't have much meaning. Maybe you believe that. Friends, I'll tell you, there's two people who really disagree with you. Number one, God really disagrees with you. Secondly, the devil really disagrees with you. He knows your life has meaning, and that's why he doesn't want you to think that it has meaning. Because the meaning of your life scares the devil and his agents. Oh, he'd love you to go on thinking that it doesn't have much meaning. Solomon understands it, that God requires an account of what is past. Verse 16. We're stepping back into depression again here in verse 16. And you'll tip it off right there. Look at verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun, right? Here we are back to an under-the-sun world, right? Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and every work. And again, he's battling back and forth between despair and understanding things in the light of eternity. Solomon looked at the world, the here and now, apart from considering eternity, and he saw that there was great evil and injustice. Instead of fair judgment, so often many times people find wickedness. And instead of righteousness, so many times people find iniquity. And this is a very significant problem under the sun. If man does not have to reckon with eternity, if this life is all there is, then many of the wicked and evil people win. Is that not true? If this life is it, if death ends it all, then do not many wicked and evil people actually win in this world? And correspondingly, many good and righteous people lose. Let's phrase it, friends. The idea of karma does not consistently work, at least not in this life. That's why Hindus who believe in karma, they got to tack on reincarnation lives, right? Because they recognize it don't really work in this life. If this life is all there is, karma doesn't really work too good. There's a lot of unjust, wicked people who seem to come out just fine, right? And there's a lot of good, godly people who end up getting trampled over. If that's not set right somewhere, sometime, then it's very troublesome. That's why Solomon finds some relief there in verse 17, where he said in his heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. The preacher said, perhaps he hoped that he knew that God would judge the righteous and the wicked, and not only in this life, because there is a time for every purpose and for every work, God will judge the deeds of man to see if it fits the proper purpose and the proper work. Now, he flirted with discouragement and despair in verses 16 and 17. He kind of rallied a little bit at the end of verse 17. Verse 18, we're plunged back into darkness here. Here he goes. I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to the animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. All will go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows what the spirit of the sons of man, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes to the earth? Concerning the condition of the sons of men, he says, they themselves are like animals. He's not talking about people living like animals. You know what he's talking about? People dying like animals. Solomon compared life between humans and animals, and he also compared their deaths, doing so under the sun, absent eternity terms. So on this basis, he could say that there's very little difference from the life and the destiny between humans and animals, as he says very powerfully, as one dies, so dies the other. The preacher thought of an animal dying and its body decomposing. And then he thought that by all outward appearance, the same happens to a human body. Therefore, They all have one breath. Man has no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. The distinction between man and animals, death cancels it out. I like what one commentator named Dean said. He said, man's boasted superiority, his power of conceiving and planning, his greatness, his skill, his strength, his cunning, all come under the category of vanity, for they cannot ward off the inevitable blow of death. There you go, Mr. and Mrs. Smarty Pants. You've achieved a lot. You've done it all, right? In an under-the-sun world, you die and your body rots just like that of a horse. That's it. That's what it's like in an under-the-sun world. But he has a different idea here in verse 22. So I perceived that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after? Again, this is the same basic idea that we've seen before, making the best of a bad situation. It's true that Solomon perceived this, but he did so on the faulty assumptions of under-the-sun thinking. And he said, nothing is better that a man should rejoice in his own works. After briefly flirting with a confidence in eternity earlier in this chapter, the preacher's return to his under-the-sun thinking, and under this premise, nothing is better than for a man to accomplish what he can in this world and to try the best he can to not trouble himself to what will happen after him. Don't think about it. You see, in this under-the-sun thinking, Solomon had an answer for the question, what will happen after him? And the answer is nothing. Under the sun, what happens after you? Nothing, because death ends it all, and ultimately, this life has no more significance than the life of that of an animal. Well, I have to say that this is a very depressing point to leave our text at, and I have no greater light for you next week. We plunge into the darkness even greater. But listen, I want to compare a couple passages just as we walk out on this. Solomon's right. In an under-the-sun world with that given premise. But I thank my Savior Jesus Christ that we don't live under the sun, that we live under the more glorious sun of eternity. We live under the bright and morning star, Jesus Christ our Lord. Remember what he said back in chapter 2, verses 20 and 22? He said, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I toiled under the sun. For what has man for all of his labor and all the striving of his heart with all that he's toiled under the sun? What good is it to work so hard and accomplish anything if death robs it all? Compare that with this passage from 1 Corinthians 15. Therefore, my brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. That's life under the bright and morning star. And it makes us what? It makes us steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Friends, when you see the contrast, we've seen a black velvet background here. On that black velvet, I've just set a beautiful diamond there for you to consider. The person and the work of Jesus Christ, our Savior. He, the bright morning star, gives meaning to our life. Let's just receive that from him and accept it together.
Thanks for listening today to the continuing study of the book of Ecclesiastes here on Enduring Word. We hope that Pastor David's message has helped you see more clearly the power of God and the need for his presence in your own life. While today's broadcast is coming to an end, you can still listen to Enduring Word by visiting our website, enduringword.com. Our website contains a vast array of audio, video, and written biblical commentaries from Pastor David Guzik, a teaching pastor at Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara. Pastor David has taken time to carefully look at each book of the Bible and has made his commentaries available for free. You could search by book or even find audio archives of special series messages available to download. One thing the Bible makes very clear to us is the need to be involved in a church community. The body of Christ functions best as a team, and your unique contributions to your church will bless your fellow believers and you in return. If you're in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to share our time of worship and Bible study with you right here at Calvary Chapel Santa Barbara. We meet each Sunday at 9 and 11 a.m. Give us a call for our location information at 805-730-1400. That phone number again is 805-730-1400. Thanks again for joining us today. Pastor David's study of the book of Ecclesiastes will continue on the next edition of Enduring Word.